I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the London Review Bookshop, where tonight we're delighted to welcome back Jeff Dyer to talk about his personal selection of D.H. Lawrence's non-fiction Life with a capital L. Lawrence is one of Jeff's great hero anti-heroes. Or maybe just hero. But
we'll clarify that.
He'll be in conversation tonight with the biographer and historian Francis Wilson, whose latest book is a biography of Thomas de Quincey. They'll talk for 40 to 45 minutes, after which there'll be some time for questions, after which questions there will be time for the signing and buying of books. On practical matters, your fire exits are the doors there and there. Please make sure your mobile phones, if you've got them, are switched to silent or even off. And when you rise to your feet in clamorous approbation at the end of the evening, don't kick over your wine glasses, because somebody always does. So now, please join me in welcoming Jeff and Francis.
So 3 years ago, I started to write a new life of D.H. Lawrence. And during that time, every time I told someone what I was up to, rather than responding as I expected them to respond, which is by snarling and spitting and saying something aggressive, which is what I'm used to as a female Laurentian, kind of educated in the 80s, they responded very differently. And the response has been a kind of a rather tender one. Slightly kooky and slightly comic and slightly amused. And they all say exactly the same thing. And it's guarded, and they put their hands up like this and say, I know everyone asks you this, and I hate to ask you, but have you read Jeff Dyer? Out of sheer rage. Now, when I say everyone has said this, I mean everyone. And I've spoken to so many people about Lawrence over the past 3 years. And so your royalty statements must be really massive.
Well, that's curious. Yeah, we have a representative of the publisher, so we can, we'll be pressing charges later.
But seriously, the conclusion I've come to is that people don't read Lawrence anymore, but they read you, and so you have single-handedly kept Lawrence alive. But the version of Lawrence that you've kept alive is the version of Lawrence that we really needed, which is comic Lawrence.
Yeah, well, God, I mean, okay, so we're right into it already. But the thing is, yeah, this is the thing. We've got Simon Winder from Penguin here as a sort of who will say something, I think, about the difficulties of publishing Lawrence. But yeah, there's comic Lawrence, but I guess the point to stress is there are a huge number of Lawrences. But I think in some ways, I'm 61, you're a little younger than me. You're significantly younger than me. You're so youthful, friend. The Lawrence that I was given, and, the same is true for many of you, it's basically the Leavis Lawrence, the Lawrence of the great tradition. That is to say, it's Lawrence the novelist. It's Sons and Lovers as a book, but really, you know, the two great books are The Rainbow and Women in Love. And even as a student, really, reading those two books with great enthusiasm, you know, I sort of struggled with them, really. And it seems to me that Lawrence is remains a really great, important writer. But there's a real problem for us with reading the books on which his reputation rests.
The canon has done him no favours at all, the canonisation of Lawrence. Why do you think, I mean, what happened that we got the Lawrence of the novels rather than the Lawrence of the essays?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair enough because, if you asked Lawrence, what were his, greatest achievements, he wouldn't say Sea and Sardinia. He would probably say it was, The Rainbow and Women in Love. Those are the books that where he's really doing something that has never been done before with the novel. They're the books that weighed on him with this enormous psychic weight. And, of course, then the story of the suppression of the rainbow, this incredible thing, which has sort of entered the realm of myth, where copies of the rainbow were burned outside
the Royal Exchange.
Yeah, yes. An incredible thing to have happened. And, I think in one of his letters he says, I'll never forgive England for what they did to the rainbow. And then Women in Love, of course, can't even get published because it's, for all sorts of reasons. I mean, so those, in a way, the canon is right. They're the books where Lawrence, that's the stuff on which Lawrence really, to which he devoted himself. Mm. But I think something strange has happened, really, in that a load of the stuff... I guess we also have to then add in Lady Chatterley because, Lawrence up until Lady Chatterley was just another great writer. And then he enters into this other realm with the famous Penguin case, where suddenly Lawrence, a copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover... I mean, I grew up in a house with no books at all, and actually I really admire my dad for this. There really weren't any books at all. But my aunt across the road, there were sort of two serious books in her house. One was Lady Chatterley's Lover. The other, interestingly, was William Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which I've recently read, which is absolutely great. But anyway, so courtesy of Lady Chatterley's Lover, he became the kind of... He enjoyed the sort of Rushdie status. Mm. That is to say, he was known by people who had no interest really in reading the book. OK, so that's a kind of different thing. But it seems to me that a lot of the stuff that Lawrence's reputation was based on contains a lot of what, for us now, is his very worst writing. But and so for you share my difficulty with The Rainbow and Women in Love.
I completely agree with you about the reorganisation of the canon. I feel that what you've done in Life with a Capital L is give us a completely fresh Lawrence. Uh-huh. And if Lawrence is ever going to kind of have a second coming, or he wanted because he saw himself as such a messianic figure, it will be with the help of this book. In fact, I was interested, looking through the essays, that they begin... Jeff's done it in a brilliant way of doing the essays chronologically. So starting in 1912 with Lawrence's essay on Christ's in the Tyrol, so walking through the Tyrol, looking at the crucifixes, and ending with the essay, the last piece of writing he did before he died, which was the introduction to the Grand Inquisitor section of Karamazov. And I thought, God, they're both about Christ. They're both about Christ. Yeah. You've begun, I thought, this journey, the journey he's taking us, the journey you're taking us on through these essays is so Laurentian. We're going all over the place, but we begin with Christ and we end with Christ. And this will be his second coming.
Great. Well, let's hope that happens. Well, maybe this is, we could actually, it would be useful to hear from you, Simon, yes. Because, I mean, I'll just tell you and let's say a little bit about how this book came to happen. I'd wanted to do a, well, actually, I knew that Simon Winder was an editor at Penguin, so I would be sort of in touch with him from time to time, mainly because I'm such a lowlife, asking for free books. But then I would intermingle those requests with this suggestion that it was time to publish a new edition of Lawrence's essays, because there hadn't really been one since, I mean, this is a book that I know people of a certain age will have, you know, these two editions of Phoenix. And then there was the selected, there was a slimmer volume of selected essays. And I believe that had been out of print for a long, long while. So I've just kept badgering Simon, saying, come on, you know, we've got to have, this is ridiculous. There's no selected, there's no Lawrence selected essays. But he'd been so traumatised, I think, by sort of successive failures to sort of rehabilitate Lawrence, that it wasn't till I published a book with Simon as my editor, the book about Where Eagles Dare, which was great, because then I had a legitimate reason both to up my rate of requests for free books and to re-intensify my lobbying for an edition of Lawrence's essays. And at some point, he relented. So I guess what I, maybe you could say, Simon, was there anything in the sort of zeitgeist that made this more viable now?
I mean,
is there a mic for him? Yeah. This has turned into a sort of Quaker meeting.
It was a revivalist thing. And I've been at Penguin, I think, for over 20 years, and I can't remember a time before a period when I didn't get notes from Jeff saying, should we do a collection of Lawrence's essays? So now we've done them. My life has no further purpose or direction.
Well, I've got another promotion-suicidal idea for you.
I mean, the problem Penguin's always faced is, of course, Penguin is famously associated with Lawrence. For many years, we published him exclusively before we went out of copyright. We sold staggering numbers of copies of Lady Chatterley. But, I mean, this appalling sense throughout my whole time at Penguin of every year selling even less Lawrence. And so we'd look back now on the dreamy period 10 years earlier where we actually sold a reasonable quantity. But it has been a ghastly feeling that there's been no, you know, like Jeff, I sort of grew up on Lawrence and I've worshipped the old, that edition, you know, and gradually there's the collapse of the great tradition, you know, because I've been involved with Penguin Classics in various ways. You know, you can see the same happening with almost all of Conrad and all of James. You know, it's a boggling collapse in new readers, even though they're revered. No one actually sort of reads them. And so in the end, I was able to, I mean, Jeff asked so often that I thought a good way of clearing my in-tray might be to say yes. But I was thinking in publishing terms, it's the equivalent of the dying samurai throwing his sword. You know? but in fact, the book's been doing extremely well. And indeed, possibly this does show this is the way in which people could approach Lawrence through your advocacy, through the look of the book, through the fact the way it's a sort of separate way of looking at Lawrence. So, I mean, so far it seems to be working. Look at this. Look at you. It's good.
This is the entire print run.
Yeah. Some of these appear to be dummies. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, Simon.
Can you tell us something, Jeff, about your selection, what you decided to include, what you decided to exclude, which is possibly more important?
Well, we go back to my days as a student. And, of course, you know, there the focus was all on the fiction. And then you would read some of the essays, but only really as a way of helping your study of the novels. So it would be, you know, all of Lawrence's many essays on the novel, or then his essays on obscenity and pornography, all this kind of stuff. So they were always just sort of stepping stones to better appreciate the fiction. So there was that. And then, I mean, when I was writing out of sheer rage, that's when I became really conscious that there is this Lawrence that remains forever fresh. I mean, just so contemporary. And, you know, out of sheer rage is one of the first of what is now a kind of quite fashionable, uncategorizable category of books. And it seemed to me that I was making a case for Lawrence as one of the first writers whose greatness might lie outside of what was considered the only real field of competition, that is to say, the novel. And yes, there was so much of Lawrence that was, subsidiary. Because Lawrence wrote so much. I mean, he died at 44. The amount he wrote was staggering. And it seemed to me that really some weird inversion of the classic hierarchy of genre was taking place, whereby, oh, yeah, I quite like the stories, which are, of course, kind of generically inferior to the novels. But I really loved the travel books. I really, really loved the essays and the sort of bits and pieces. And then I loved the poems, which were sort of not even poems. They were just sort of jottings, really. So, OK, and the idea was to find a way of bringing into one volume as wide a range as possible of Lawrence's of Lawrence's work. And in the previous editions of the essays, they were always categorised. But as you know, any kind of categorising with Lawrence completely falls apart, because an essay on one thing is always an essay on a load of other things. And there's a wonderful comment by the Lawrence scholar James T. Bolton. He talks about the essay called Introduction to Pictures, which doesn't once mention pictures.
No. I remember it's mainly about venereal disease.
An amazing history of Western art seen in the light of this terror of the body. So there was, there's so much, and it starts really, there was, for example, one of the times when I realised just how sort of wild Lawrence, I like wild writers, and I always come back to that moment when was writing the biography of Emerson, and Annie Dillard said to him, "What you've got to realise, Bob, is that Emerson is wild." And it seems to me that Lawrence is just so wild, and the wild Lawrence I first encountered was in his study of Thomas Hardy.
Yes.
And whereas for a while I think books like Twilight in Italy, they're sort of available in Penguin, I think study of Thomas Hardy has been really out of print, except for those very expensive Cambridge University Press scholarly editions. So the idea really was to make available again as much of this really kind of crazy stuff as possible, including, there's, of course, I include, some of the essays on the novel, but there's loads of wonderful autobiographical writing, and there's loads of this really kind of very little known stuff, such as, it's interesting, whenever anybody would send a book to Lawrence, basically hoping for a blurb, let's say the way that happens now, one of two things would happen. Either Lawrence would rewrite it, as he did with Molly Skinner, didn't he?
Yes.
Or if you asked him later on in life to write an introduction to Apocalypse, he'd write his own book about Apocalypse.
Yes.
And then, perhaps you could explain about the other thing, that sort of huge thing that grew completely out of control, the amazing 80-page, is it, essay that he writes on Magnus's, the introduction to Memoirs of the Foreign Legion.
Yes, yes.
So you explain about that.
No, so there. This is the... this is the creme de la creme for me of this collection, is that at last we have an easily available, accessible copy of the Memoirs of Maurice Magnus, which has been otherwise impossible to find. And I've had the copy out of London University Library for 4 years, and I had to take it back now. But I could return it because I've now got it here. And what's extraordinary about this essay, and I am absolutely obsessed with it, is how funny it is and how completely unclassifiable it is and how mischievous it is and totally, totally wrong. And what it's...
wrong in what sense?
That what Lawrence behaved so badly in writing this piece. So what it's about is Maurice Magnus is one of the strange characters who kind of wander into Lawrence's life. And he's homosexual, although Lawrence will never mention this, but Lawrence's obsession with him is his homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And he's on the run from the police, which fascinates Lawrence, because Lawrence is also on the run when he meets him in Italy in 1919. And he's escaped from the French Foreign Legion, and he's very theatrical. And he's completely broke, and he starts to borrow money from Lawrence. And Lawrence is very, very complicated about lending money. And is that, remember that poem about money? He said, "You never, I never ever lend anyone a fiver without it killing me inside." And Marius Magnus kind of bleeds money out of Lawrence. And Lawrence is kind of sucked into Marius Magnus's kind of personal chaos. And Frida's going, "Why have you picked up this complete loser?" And Lawrence can't let him go. And then Marius Magnus kills himself, and he leaves behind him for Lawrence to publish his memoir of the French Foreign Legion. And Maurice and Lawrence says, in order to clear Magnus's debts, which have been tremendous, he'll publish this, but only with his own introduction. And in his introduction, which we've got reproduced here, Lawrence completely destroys Maurice Magnus's character. He talks about him. It's very, very funny the way he destroys his character. He destroys him, and then he builds him up again, and then he destroys him again. But in the meantime, he describes his friendship with Maurice Magnus and with Magnus's friend Norman Douglas, almost like a kind of Charlie Chaplin film. That Morris Magnus walks in these mincing little steps. He looks like a tomtit dressed up to look like a sparrow. Something he's got for every one of Lawrence's strides, Morris Magnus has 10 little steps. And he's so evidently, Lawrence is so evidently inspired by Silent Movie, which he claims to hate. Uh-huh. But I think he sees the whole thing in terms of a silent film. Mm-hmm. And I do think when I read, I mean, no one's ever sort of written about Maurice Magnus, except me. But I do think when I read that essay and I always get so much pleasure from it, why isn't this at the centre of what we think about when we think about Lawrence?
Yes. Yeah.
With this man who was just he was a brilliant mimic. And
famously brilliant in the days before television, that's apparently all you could do to entertain yourself. You just mimic people.
And if Lawrence was here now, he'd be taking off me and he'd be taking off Jeff and you'd all be hands and knees laughing about it, because he was a complete parrot, wasn't he?
Yeah, a fantastic company, allegedly. Well, I guess this is fantastic company for a while. And I think this is that... scenario you've described with Maurice is so typical throughout Lawrence. The pattern is repeated endlessly in Lawrence's life, from his first meeting with all of the people at Garsington, such as Bertrand Russell. You know, they meet Lawrence, they think, oh my God, this minor son is just this incredible genius.
Well, he always said that he was only called a genius because he was a minor son.
Because he lacked their incomparable advantages. Yeah. And then, of course, Lawrence is always hatching up grand schemes, you know, the grandest of which was destined never to happen, you know, to found this community, Rananim. And I love the way that Lawrence designed the badge for this. And then the pattern would always be, there would always be the fallout. Lawrence comes crashing into people's lives. And I think the famous episode with Bertrand Russell really exemplifies this. They then form an allegiance to try to stop the First World War. And Bertrand Russell, of course, is a pacifist. And Lawrence, you know, famously says to him, oh, the only reason you're a pacifist is because your deepest desire in life is to bury an axe in somebody's head. And Russell said that this insight into his character made him contemplate suicide until he realised that Lawrence, as everyone would do eventually, is it was just a lunatic. And so, always then, having built this friendship alliance, there's then the inevitable bust-up. And that just goes through every relationship Lawrence has. Catherine Mansfield, John Middleton Murray. But as with all people who are... and then, of course, you've got this other thing. I think we all have this thing in our relationships. You know, you like the husband, not the wife. You like the wife, not the husband. There's Frida in the mix as well.
The terrific problem of Frida.
The huge, but also the kind of great thing, because, I mean, yeah, we'll talk about that. But one of the things that united Frida and Lawrence is that neither of them were sulkers.
Yes.
You know, so Lawrence with his famous temper, you know... He, you know, there were all those anecdotes that one moment, you know, he'd be seen trying to strangle Frida, the next minute they'd be cooing,
and talking about macaroni cheese.
And then so Lawrence has all these fallings out with people, and then but he's always happy to sort of pick it up again. You know, there's no lifelong falling out with anybody that I can think of, except that people like Catherine Mansfield die before before it's got a chance to revive. So yeah, I feel that, you know, and so as a result, anyone who met Lawrence for more than 5 minutes has written a memoir of their time with him.
Yes.
And maybe I could ask you this, Fran, rather rudely, given that, you know, I was here about 10 years or more ago with John Worthing to talk about his full-length biography of Lawrence, which came out after his the segment of the three-part biography he'd done. David Ellis, who wrote part three of the Cambridge biography, he also did another smaller book about Lawrence. There's the great Brenda Maddox biography. Are you really writing another biography of Lawrence? Who needs it?
Okay, well, I am, and I'm not. I think that, well, for me, there are so many lives of Lawrence, as you say, and they're completely unsatisfying as far as I can see. I think they're very, very boring.
Oh, I so disagree.
Okay.
I think they're nearly, I think the standard of Lawrence biographies is so high. I love that three-parter, although I know that's a bit much.
It's a source book. It's not a... It doesn't get inside Lawrence like you get inside Lawrence and out of sheer rage. That's the only book about Lawrence that really gives you a sense of what it was like to be in the room with Lawrence. Otherwise, I see the biographies as extended Wikipedia entries.
Even, what about... I worry that I'm now potentially generating revenue for Brenda Maddox rather than me, but I really felt that her biography, The Married Man, although it's slightly dubious in terms of documentary, I felt that gave a real sense of what it was like to be with Lawrence.
I'd completely disagree.
Wow, OK. Is she in the room tonight,
No,
Brenda?
She recently died.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. I felt it didn't work for me at all. And also she...
That what you thought I just said, that was a strange collective hallucination. That you're all suffering from.
No. I know, exactly, yeah. No, and that book disappointed me because it's the only life of Lawrence by a woman. Otherwise, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that every other biographer has been a man. And so I wanted to have something of how controversial Lawrence is for women in that book, but there was nothing at all. But what I think the biographies of... what I think they've done is they've hammered Lawrence down and made him into a much more conventional person than he is. And I think I'm like you. I like the wildness of him. I like the madness of him. I like the fury. And I'm completely... When you describe, as you did so well, Lawrence falling out with people all the time, my question is, why? Why was he so angry? And why did he fall out with everyone? I don't need it to be repeated for me in every biography. They all are the same book. And then he met him and he fell out with him and he wrote him up in this book. And then he met her and fell out with her and wrote him in that book. I want someone to get inside him and say, OK, were there two Lawrences? Was there Lawrence one and Lawrence two? Everyone who met Lawrence said, there are two of him. That's the really engaging, charming man who knows the names of every flower in the wood and is just wonderful company. And then there's a tannoy system. And when the tannoy system comes into the novels in the form of Rupert Birkin in Women in Love, he destroys his own art. And Lawrence doesn't seem to recognise that he's got this self-destructive streak. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to recognise... Everyone else recognised it, but he couldn't, in the same way that he couldn't recognise that he was a crap painter.
He
thought his paintings were as good as his poems.
Well, he thought his paintings were the sort of culmination of the Western art tradition.
Well, it's so interesting, I think, that he couldn't tell when he couldn't see his own genius. And so he couldn't really see himself at all. And I think because he had so little interest in himself as a maker of art. He had much more interest, and you described this in Out of Sheer Rage, he had much more interest in himself as a maker of cupboards, as a DIY man, and he took his genius for granted. But what he didn't take for granted was the fact that he saw himself as prophet, And that's where it all seemed to go wrong, I think. And that's what Frieda made him feel. There's Lawrence before Frieda and Lawrence after Frieda. And I don't like what any of the biographers have done with Frieda. I don't think anyone, I mean, they describe her as a swamp. I mean, that is literally the term they use. It's sort of this swamp of a woman, the immovable fact of Frieda. And I think Frieda was half of Lawrence.
Yeah, I mean, she is responsible for a lot of what's bad in Lawrence, in that she is the conduit through whom he got in touch with all of these fashionable German psychoanalytic ideas and so forth. And of course, Lawrence, isn't it wonderful? I mean, this would be interesting to hear from Simon. You know, Lawrence wrote these two books, Fantasia of the Unconscious and Psychoanalysis of the Unconscious. Would it be true to say they're not in print? Well, let's more modestly, would it be true to say they're not his best-selling titles?
In a crowded field, they're not his best-selling
titles. Yes, yeah. I mean, but yeah, there's that. Yeah, so I think there's that whole kind of swirl of kind of avant-garde, you know, thought, which finds its way into the Rainbow and Women in Love.
Yes, but I love that crazy German streak in him, and it comes straight from Otto Rank, as you say, Frieda's engagement in that extraordinary moment of German kind of anarchistic philosophy at the turn of the century. And I think that Lawrence on the Unconscious is really interesting, and I like the fact that he sees the unconscious actually as a physical organ like the liver. You know, it's not something abstract, it's something that's properly there. Sitting
would that
in the
be
body.
That mysterious part of the body which always seems to move around in Lawrence, the loins.
Yes, the dark loins. I think it would be really good to just map a body. This is Laurentian body, and here's the loins, and here's the unconscious kind of kidney shaped or liver shaped. Yeah, and here's. And another, I mean, what you describe really well in Out of Sheer Age by impersonating it and reenacting it is all the contradictions in Lawrence. Yeah. And so the book is Laurentian because you become all those contradictions. And the biggest contradiction in Lawrence, no biographer has done anything with this, as I say, only you have, is the fact that he was an entirely intellectual man who only believed in the body as the centre of thought. But his body was dying. And his body had failed him since the day he was born. And he never, ever admitted to having tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. But and his own analysis of tuberculosis was that it was, and he puts this in his books on psychoanalysis. And I ran this past a New Age friend of mine who said she thought it was brilliant and not at all to be laughed at. And he said that his mother gave him TB by making him excessively loving. And it's the pressure of love on. It's the pressure of love on the kind of the sternum, which presses down into the lungs. And I said, God, isn't he mad about the body? And she said, no, it's absolutely right about tuberculosis.
Well, but there's, on the other hand, there's, you know, you could go through Lawrence. I mean, that Lawrence comes up with 24 explanations about what is wrong with him. Quite often he says, oh, you know, I'm feeling ill, but I know it's... Well, first of all, it's never the lungs. It's always the bronchioles.
Yeah, or the stomach.
Or the stomach. Anything but the thing it really is. It's only about 2 weeks before his death that he finally says something like, you know, I think one of my lungs is a bit tubercular. The scale of the denial is incredible. So he'll blame it on the nerves. Quite often he'll blame it on the rage induced in him by England and Europe.
Yes.
And there's a rather brilliant passage in the Brenda Maddox book where quite often she says, after a certain point, Lawrence is maintaining his altitude like a pilot whose plane is in trouble, just trying to get maximum glide from it to find a climate that suits him. Yes. And of course, Lawrence famously falls out not just with people, but with places. And he never, ever will forgive a place that he gets ill in.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, he just turns his back on so, you know, of course, that's why he hated Sri Lanka, where he got unbelievably ill. But, where were we, Fran? Just remind me. Illness, this kind of stuff.
The contradictions,
oh,
the denial.
That's right. Oh, yes, and Frieda. Yeah, so on the one hand, I feel that She's responsible for a lot of the things that worked to the detriment of Lawrence's and novelist.
She didn't have to deny. I mean, Lawrence was in denial about his TB, but so was Frieda.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. And the Huxleys were outraged at the sort of nursing care. But I think also, weirdly, I mean, it's such a complex relationship because I feel that nobody has summed up what we still today love in Lawrence better than Frieda when she says something like, to me, it was just so wonderful, his immediate communication with his immediate bond with everything, flowers, trees, all this kind of stuff, with no kind of mediation via theory, just that kind of instantaneous kind of rapport he had. And what I really love about that is that it's so close to what one of Lawrence's sisters said about Lawrence's dad, who, of course, Lawrence famously said he was born hating. And one of the sisters says about the dad, oh, yeah, he knew the names of flowers and birds and that.
Yes,
And that is what is so valuable in Lawrence. And I find that really it's, I mean, what I liked about this, one of the reasons I felt the only way to arrange this book was chronologically is because of the mad scatter of it. And really, whatever Lawrence is writing, whether it's a big book, The Rainbow, some little postcard that he's sending to somebody, or a poem, you just never know when there's going to be the next outbreak of just such incredible genius.
Yes.
I mean, you know, there's just loads of examples. But, you know, I mean, I think...
No, I was looking at the moments of incredible genius. Just when he's writing about... you included a couple of his reviews, which are always... Mm. And Lawrence as a reader is just so exciting, isn't he? And this is him on Hemingway. And he says, Mr. Hemingway's sketches are so excellent. They're like striking a match, lighting a brief sensational cigarette, and then it's over.
It's just remarkable that, that Lawrence reviewed Hemingway, reviewed Thomas Mann as well. I think back to, because part of this, I mean, I'm really, now that I'm sort of in my 60s, I sort of find myself thinking all the time about those formative years when when you discover Lawrence. And yeah, Lawrence's reputation was still very much intact, you know, when I was 17, 18. And I can so remember just reading that poem, Song of a Man Who Has Come Through. And out of nowhere, there's this line in it when he just says, a fine wind is blowing the new direction of time.
It's wonderful, yeah.
I mean, and then it just goes on something else, load of nonsense. But these kind of wonderful lines are just cropping up all over the place. And one of Lawrence's great gifts, I think, was his... I always think of Kerouac in a way, that he has this freedom from self-editing. I mean, he became a kind of apostle of... You know, he became famous for let's get rid of our inhibitions. But I think one of his great strengths also was that he was so uninhibited as a writer and didn't really care if he was writing a lot of nonsense. Although, of course, he was a compulsive rewriter of his own stuff. I forgot to say also that one of the problems we have if we're going to make the claim for Lawrence the novelist, then we have to really, then you're saying, what, you know, the plumed serpent? Aaron's Rod, Kangaroo. Mm. I mean, these are, apart from Lady Chatterley's Lover, after Women in Love, Lawrence as a novelist is really pretty well over with.
There are accounts of what it was like to be Lawrence while he wrote the books.
Yes, indeed.
They're not about anything else. And in that sense, they're very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think all the essays here are... accounts of what it's like to be Lawrence while he wrote the essays.
Well, yeah, indeed. And that's the really interesting thing in the travel writing. I mean, he wrote these wonderful travel books, the ones about Italy, and then there's the Mexico ones, and then the essays about New Mexico. And it's like this famous sort of thing is he just responding with unbelievable sensitivity to what's going on? And the most famous example, I guess, is when he goes to that letter from Germany from, is it 1923 or something like that? And he's in the Black Forest and he says, oh, I can feel something. All he's doing is describing the weather. But he says, something is brewing here, something that is coming from far, further back than the Christian ear, and it's going to result in... And,
fine, you know, wind is blowing.
You know, yeah, except this is the opposite of a fine wind. This is not the new... It's sort of blowing us backwards. And you think, oh, my God, is he intuiting the rise of Nazism, even though there's nothing really about politics in it? And similarly, when he goes to Australia and he gives you think, oh, my God, he's only been here 2 weeks and he's got a sense of the dream time, of the song lines, you know. Other times, as, as this is what Rebecca West says in the essay, oh, it's such good
value. And it's included
here.
Yeah. Oh, that's me telling you that's time to stop.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah. Oh,
can you just say something about Rebecca West? Because it's very, very funny.
Yeah, and it's this story which it seems to me, she says, you know, it's... she's in Florence to meet Norman Douglas, who rather snootily says, oh, Lawrence is here, and I bet if we go round to his crummy hotel room, he'll already be writing an article about Florence. And they go round there, and they can sort of hear him writing his piece. I think he's banging out a typewriter. And they go in, and they say, what are you doing? And he replies, I can't do the accent, because incredibly, there's no audio at all of Lawrence. Very surprising, actually, given how famous he was. And he says he's writing about Florence. And, of course, Rebecca West thinks this is both hilarious and really stupid because he doesn't know the first thing about Florence. But, of course, he's always eager to earn money. And, of course, he's staying in a really crummy hotel because in Brenda Maddox's great phrase, he was, to say the least, very careful about money. Anyway, and then Lawrence dies and... Rebecca West famously says in this essay, she says, God, I realise that actually all Lawrence ever wrote about was the state of his own soul. And at that moment, Florence was as good a symbol as any other.
I just want to say, just before we have questions, something about how Rebecca West is a superb critic of Lawrence. Everything she says about Lawrence is right. But women always are. And what's very interesting in what happened in the Lawrence... trajectory is that the people who first wrote about Lawrence so well were all women.
Oh, like Catherine Carswell.
Catherine Carswell and Mabel Dodge, Lujan. I think it's absolutely brilliant, her book Lorenzo in Taos.
Oh,
it's superb. And so every woman that Lawrence knew wrote about him astonishingly well. And the women were there. The women had no problem with Lawrence until Kate Millett.
Oh, yes.
And then when Kate Millett came along, the women had a huge problem with Lawrence.
From which he's never recovered.
From which he's never recovered. You know, it was his death sentence. And we haven't ever... We should put him on the shitty men in literature list.
Yes,
and he's never come off. And that's what I wanted Brenda Maddox to do something with.
But that's what you're doing.
Well, it's funny. It's what I thought I was doing when I first started writing about him. But in fact, I'm so uninterested in what Lawrence has to say about sex that I can hardly be bothered to go
you're
there.
Yeah, right.
Well, we haven't mentioned it once, have we?
No, we really haven't. That's, all I would add is, in terms of women on Lawrence, the most amazing... There's this just wonderful little glimpse of Lawrence in Italy. I think... I'm not sure which way round it is. It's either Virginia Woolf on a train in Italy seeing Lawrence at a station or the other way around. She's on the platform and Lawrence's train pulls in. Anyway, and she sees Lawrence and she sees him looking pinched and penetrated. What a description of Lawrence, of course, who's being eaten away by the disease that he refuses to name, but also sort of by life, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Pinched and penetrated.
Yes.
Yes. So, if anyone is in the room who knew Lawrence, please, we can have some sort of questions now or statements of position.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yes, please. Oh, I think there's a microphone for you.
I was just struck by the fact you both touched on Frida, but and you seem to have quite differing opinions on her, and I wondered if you could both say a bit more about your attitudes to Frida.
Yeah, what's your line on Frida?
Well, I think on the one hand, you know, it was such a she was such a liberation. So there's, you know, Lawrence as this sort of, you know, horny young man at the sort of turn of the century, always trying to get these women to have sex with him, who for various reasons have reservations about it. And then, of course, he meets this German woman who, according to Brenda Maddox's famously unreliable account, within about 20 minutes of meeting him, says, "Do you want to come upstairs? Because Ernest, my husband, is out at the library at the moment."
She completely misses the point of that. Had she not decided to invent that scene, she might have said something really interesting about what happened in the 20 minutes that Lawrence met Frida, because during that conversation, the deal was done. It had nothing to do with sex. And if she hadn't put that in, we might have been able to think seriously about what really connected them.
Which was?
Well, I think they both describe what happened, I think. So Lawrence turns up to see his tutor. It's very important to Lawrence that Frida is married to his tutor. Of course, you know, of course that's significant. He turns up to see his tutor to get a letter of recommendation to a university in Germany. He's just had his second very serious illness. And he's kind of, you know, he's despairing. He can't find anyone to have sex with him, as Jeff said. And he comes into this house and, Christ, there's this extraordinary woman there. I mean, she's astonishingly beautiful and kind of huge bosomed and blonde and full of kind of... And she's already involved with a couple of men in Germany. She's just had a big affair with Otto Rank. And another of her lovers, who's a German anarchist, is currently in prison. So she's been leading this kind of double life for a long time. And she doesn't really want to stay being a bourgeois housewife. And the minute she sees Lawrence, she evidently starts telling him everything about her life. And he starts telling her everything about his life. And they talk frantically, like we're talking now. They kind of pour it all out because they're waiting for, you know, Ernest Weekly to come down the stairs, and then they've got to have lunch. And Frida said, well, we talked about Oedipus. And as far as Lawrence was concerned, Oedipus was the play running in the Nottingham Playhouse. As far as Frida was concerned, Oedipus was a complex which she'd heard all about in Germany. So she brought that to the deal. And Lawrence thought, oh, God! He was in the middle of writing Sons and Lovers. And he just, you know, he left that day saying, you know, I've just met the most wonderful woman in all of England.
Yeah.
And he meant it was an extraordinary meeting. And the fact that Brenda Maddox says, you know, they arrived and they went upstairs and had a shag and then came downstairs and had dinner. It just seems, I don't know, I think that's such a misreading of who Lawrence was. He was such a prude. He would never have behaved like that with his tutor's wife in the house. You know, and also, I mean, he made himself out to be sexually liberated. He was the most uptight man in the world.
On the other, but as a sort of parable, I mean, so, but you've sort of conceded that compared with the women that Lawrence had met before, she was this enormous kind of sexual force.
Yes. Yes, she was. So there was a promise of sex.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is always better than...
And then, of course, then it becomes very interesting because late, you know, she's older than him. And then several people who encountered them in Mexico commented, oh, God, you know, there's this, you know, this big German woman seems more like his mum than his wife, you know. And given how abnormally close to his mother he was, it all gets very, very interesting.
And I think it mattered to Lawrence a lot that Frieda was a mother. That Frieda, it was really important to Lawrence that Frieda left her children for him. And his behaviour about her leaving her children was unspeakable. That he refused to accept that she'd lost anything here. Now, so when she'd cry about her, when she ran away with Lawrence, she didn't know she would never see her children again. And Lawrence was going, oh, God, they're better off without you. I mean, every child needs to be without its mother. Mothers can only destroy your life. He said all these things to her. She said, well, no, I do actually miss them and I'd like to see them. And that was one of the reasons why Lawrence would then beat her up.
And get beaten up. Back.
And get beaten up. Yeah, God, she could swing it. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's those. I mean, yeah, that's our thoughts on Frieda. I guess the other thing to say is, you know, she was nothing if not up for it. In that, you know, after after they're stuck in Cornwall during the First World War, at the moment they're allowed to travel, they embark on this just incredible life of travelling the world, always on the cheap, always third class, of just a life of, it was, you know, it was a very, very demanding life for her and very different to Lawrence, who, of course, for a big chunk of each day is just there writing, you know, whereas
What did Frieda do all day?
Yeah, well, she...
Because he did the cooking and the cleaning and grew the vegetables and washed the floors and he made her breakfast in bed. And we know she smoked a lot.
Which he hated.
So she... And she smoked in his face because he had TB. And so she... I mean, she seemed to do... And then he wrote a couple of novels. I mean, it took him 6 weeks to write a novel. So he was incredibly busy and getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And she was very, very lazy. And getting fatter and fatter and fatter. And he had an agenda in moving around the world, and she had no agenda. So there was this kind of aimless egotism to her, which I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think, I think Frieda is fascinating. And I don't think you really get what's going on in Lawrence's head until you've got Frieda, because a trip switch went when he met her. And the writing changed, but also he changed. And she's always marginalised in the Lawrence studies. And Frieda was there. Frieda was literally never there. I mean, wherever he was, she was. I mean, they were never... They were Laurel and Hardy. Well, sorry, it's never not there. They were Laurel and Hardy together. They were...
Great. Yeah. OK. Are we OK for another question or two?
Absolutely. This may be a sort of niche interest, but I'm a primary school teacher. Have been for a long time, and I'm conscious that Lawrence is the only major novelist or writer that I know of who was a primary school teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And I love The Rainbow and find women in love really difficult, but one of the reasons I love The Rainbow is there's a chapter in The Rainbow has a better description of the experience of beginning teaching than any novel I know.
Really? Okay.
And my thought that goes from that about Lawrence is that one of the pleasures of being a primary school teacher is you can get interested in anything and everything.
Yeah.
One of the dangers of being a primary school teacher is you can ramble on and on and on because the children probably won't stop you.
Is this a
So I'm just, that's my reflection. I'm just thinking of Lawrence as a primary school teacher, ex-primary school teacher.
Who rambled on and on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's so interesting. It hadn't occurred to me, but you're right. He got his training as a teacher, and that he must have taken that training into his writing. But he saw himself completely as a teacher, didn't he?
Well, yes, as a teacher who could heal the kind of, teacher and saviour. I mean, all those elements that you've quite rightly said we find rather unpalatable now. But I guess one thing we should add is that, I mean, my father-in-law is rereading volume 5 of Henry James's Letters, and I remember thinking, God on earth is he, why is he doing that? And then I realised, oh, I've just reread volume 7 of Lawrence's Letters. And one of the lovely things in Lawrence's Letters is towards the end, there is this, he's still kind of going completely berserk about things, but there is a kind of lovely gentleness in some of those letters, or rather a sort of accommodation that he makes with things. And there's far less sort of ranting and raving. I mean, there's a lot of sort of business letters. But the kind of lyricism that is there and the just the sort of gentleness when he, you know, and by then he's completely abandoned his idiotic belief in a sort of, you know, in the sort of fascist cult of the leader. You know, he's no longer saying things like, you know, I don't believe in democracy. I believe in the inherited right of kings. And he's not saying things like the Cornish people are so worthless they should just be used as slaves. I mean, he comes round to a much nicer kind of social democratic view of the world, let's say.
Wherein does his greatness lie for you? I said, why now? Why Lawrence now? What does he have to say to us now?
Oh, I think it would be this thing of the crucial thing, the elevation of forms of work which have traditionally been regarded as lower down. And also just the immediacy of some of his writing without any rhetoric, without that tannoy that we use. So for me, that's where it is. And also, as you mentioned, as a critic, you mentioned those reviews. But for me, I mean, you know, if I was asked to choose, you know, Lawrence, you know, what is the one Lawrence book to take away, I'd be sorely tempted to choose Studies in Classic American Literature.
I agree.
Because it's great on, you know, Melville, Whitman, all this kind of stuff, and it's also completely nuts.
Yes. Yes. I think one of the things that makes him so relevant today is that he invented autofiction.
Oh, yes. Yeah, indeed. It's
and there was no one had described, as Lawrence had described. I mean, Lawrence turned autobiography into the novel. They're indistinguishable. Mm-hmm. And Knausgaard and Rachel Cusk would not exist without Lawrence.
Cusk is a very big...
She's a big Lawrence fan. Yeah, she... Oh. Sorry.
Anyway, ma'am.
I grew up in Nottingham, and I knew that Lawrence had become unfashionable. But... I would like to put in a few words for the great novels, because I read them first when I was a schoolgirl in Nottingham. And, you know, knowing what miners' lives were like and understanding just a little, perhaps a little bit more than we would today, of the, you know, the ghastly degradation and poverty that he must have grown up in, and knowing his house and the little sculpted coal things that he made, which glisten. You know, those were the only shiny things in the house. And I thought and still think that those novels are definitely worthy of reading and definitely worthy of understanding of how you escape from a life like that. Because, you know, would the world have taken a slightly different turn, he might have become a miner and just followed in his father's footsteps. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he had a little chance with education, a little chance with the people he knew, and did amazing things with it. So I'd just like to sort of put that point to feel that those novels are not worth reading.
Mm. Yes, that's really impressive.
Would be a shame, because I think I personally enjoyed them and enjoy rereading them now.
That's a very useful corrective. The only thing I would say is that I feel that dimension of experience for me is presented more powerfully in Sons and Lovers for me than it is in the Rainbow and Women in Love.
Well, I would put those three.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. And I'm glad we've ended actually with that, with that corrective, because it would be kind of... It would be unfortunate if the takeaway from this was to say, don't bother reading Lawrence's novels.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That would be demented. Yeah.
The takeaway should be that there's so much more.
Yeah.
There's always another Lawrence essay, always another Lawrence poem. We haven't even begun with Lawrence.
No.
And the short stories.
The short stories are masterful, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you, Francis.
Thank you.
Round of applause, please.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.